You're listening to the Girls Talk podcast, hosted by me, Adria Burr, and powered by our friends at Nike. This is where girls come together to talk, share, listen, and take control. So listen to us every week for your source of fierce chat. And don't forget to subscribe. Hi everyone, I'm massively happy to be sat here with the incredibly multi-talented Olympic fencer, Ibtihaj Mohammed. We've just been talking together on a panel with Caitlin Ohashi, Sky Dickinson and Janaya Khan in front of an audience of female role models who are using sport as a platform to ignite change for the next generation. There was a mad amount of positive energy in the room. We're ending the day on another high. I'm beyond excited to have Ibtihaj as a guest on the Girls Talk podcast. She's a role model for so many reasons. Not only did she earn the bronze medal for the Team USA sabre fencing in the Rio Olympics, but she became the first American athlete to compete in the Olympics wearing hijab. Ibtihaj has launched her own modest clothing company. She's an author, a sports ambassador, and an important figure in a larger global discussion on equality and the importance of sport. And for a very good reason, she was named Time's 100 Most Influential People of 2016. We're here at the Nike Legacy Summit. Ibtihaj, thank you so much for being on the Girls Talk podcast. Usually in my lovely little studio in Soho, we're now in this amazing warehouse in LA, mm-hmm. not far from where you live.
Yeah.
But I didn't say where we are, so no one can stalk.
So I don't have any surprises at my door.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. So one of the first questions that I asked on the panel was about role models. And I know this is kind of, it has become such a buzzword and one that sometimes I don't even understand what it necessarily means to be a role model. But you spoke really eloquently about the role models that were in your life, but also the ones that were shown to you by your parents. Mm-hmm. Would you tell my lovely audience a bit more about that?
I agree with you. I think that it's become quite a buzz term recently, this idea of role models and like what that means. And when I think about just these influential people that I've had in my life, like you said, sometimes they came in the form of characters in a book. My mom, who's an educator, was very intentional about the book she put in front of her, you know, like brown children. She wanted us to see ourselves in the people that we read about. So a lot of my picture books growing up were historical figures like Jackie Robinson, Althea Gibson, Muhammad Ali, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, just people that, whether they were like in the sciences or in sports, they gave us as African-American children, this lens into our community that often wasn't shown to us. And when I think about those moments as a kid where they kind of allowed me to unconsciously graph my dreams and aspirations, I appreciate my parents, you know, for doing that for us, because it's really easy not to see yourself in children's literature these days. And then to speak about a role model that I've had, especially as a professional athlete, I know that she was a guest on your show, Serena Williams. I've always looked to her and Venus as a source of inspiration. Their unapologetic attitude in sport and on the tennis court, I think, has been transformational for and inspirational, not just for me, but Black girls around the world who have had the opportunity to see them play from a really early age. They show us that, yes, we can exist, and yes, we can be great, and yes, we can be unapologetic about our existence.
And talking of seeing yourself in literature, I know you've written 3 books, but one of those being a book for children about a lovely little girl wearing a hijab. Mm-hmm. So was this something that, you know, was this part of your thought process in terms of your childhood and being given these books that led you to then write a book for other children? Mm-hmm.
I knew when I signed my book deal for my memoir, Proud, I knew I wanted to eventually do a children's book, right? My book agent may not have known, my publisher may not have known, but that was always my plan. And so when The Proudest Blue, the children's book, when that idea came to fruition, I knew it had to be a book that had a Black character, but also she had to wear hijab. When you look at children's literature, this character doesn't exist. And there are millions of Muslims around the world. When you think about the Black community, the Muslim Black community, we're so often forgotten and not a part of the conversation and not included in this very large global narrative of Muslims. I knew how important it was for this book to happen. And I wanted it to be a story that, yes, is about hijab and about family, but it's also about this universal experience of bullying. I remember being bullied as a kid for wearing hijab. And my favorite line of the book after, you know, Asiya is bullied for wearing hijab, favorite line of the book comes from, you know, mom in the book. And it says, don't carry those words. They're not yours to keep. Right. And that's something that's, I think, applicable not just to children, but also us as adults. Like, you know, you don't have to hold on to those words that people say to you. They're hurtful, yes, but you don't have to hold on to them. They're not yours. You drop them and you move on. And The Proudest Blue is not only a mirror for Muslim kids to see themselves in literature, it's also a window for those who may not be of my faith, but for them to see hijab told in a different light. It's not a story of oppression that we've been told. It's not a story of negativity. It's something that we celebrate. And why not teach our kids to celebrate differences and to celebrate inclusion and love that we're all different instead of constantly breaking one another down for being different? I knew that in the sport of fencing, I was always going to be one of one, right, in this space. I knew I was going to be, you know, likely the only Black kid competing. I knew I for sure was going to be the only, you know, little Muslim girl in hijab. And one thing that I love about sport is the power to unify. It's not about where you're from, how much money you have. It's not about your gender. It's not about your sexual orientation or your faith. None of those things matter. It's like, can you win? And that was this kind of safety blanket almost, and this comfort that I found in sport is that it was like, I just have to work hard to basically beat everybody. Like, that was always my goal. And, you know, on the panel earlier, I talked about not having a love for fencing in particular. I love sports, but I'd never had a real affinity for fencing itself. I think that my drive has always come from being told no. Like, there are always people around me who are saying that I didn't belong in sport because I wore hijab. I shouldn't be fencing because I was Black. You know, maybe I wasn't good enough. People try to pigeonhole you as a Black athlete for only being strong. And in my sport, it's not about brute strength. That's not how you find yourself on an Olympic podium. It's really like outsmarting your opponent. So to be told as a Black athlete, the only thing you bring to the table is your strength. It's intentional. There is so much intention behind those words because people don't want you to see your full potential. So I've had to be so myopic in my thought process about my ability to be successful in my sport. And it never came from outside sources. I had to learn to believe in myself, and I had to learn resilience from a really early age within the sport of fencing.
What do you love now?
What do I love now?
Yeah. Within my sport. If it's not necessarily fencing, yeah, what do you love?
I love the opportunity to use my platform for good. You know, I think that fencing was a vehicle to get me to where I am today, but it's the opportunity to, you know, work with amazing entities like Nike, for example, where you're able to reach, you know, probably billions of people. Like, just if it's the swipe of a sword or something simple that you do on your social channels, it's the opportunity to be an agent of change. And to me, that's what matters, right? If I have, you know, someone like Muhammad Ali, who I look to, right, not just for his work in the boxing ring, but the work outside the boxing ring, where he literally thought of us as humans first, right? And he thought of people who are on the other side of the world who were suffering. When he thought about the Black community here in the United States that was suffering, and he said, you know, it's not about my money, it's not about my own safety, my family's safety, it's about us uplifting these oppressed communities. I feel like I have really big shoes to fill. And it's like, what can I do to be an agent of change and be really intentional about that fight to change the world?
Does it feel like a privilege to know that you have some really big shoes to fit? I know it can feel sometimes like a pressure, but I remember speaking, I think it was Serena Williams, and she said it, that all that pressure felt like a privilege. And I know you spoke downstairs about, you know, the gratitude that you have, even through all the kind of darkest times that you've been and everything that you've got through. But you come across as a very kind of positive person.
It's I mean, you have to think of it as privilege. All of this stuff can be taken in a heartbeat, right? Who knows if I'm going to like live to see tomorrow, right? Who knows if as an athlete, you first of all, you could lose, you could break a leg, anything could happen, right? So you have to think of every single opportunity, every chance as if it's your last. And I want to take advantage of these opportunities because I know that tomorrow's not promised. And I feel like if I think back to my younger self and not seeing someone who looked like me in these spaces, yeah, it would have been cool to see someone who looked like me because I could have achieved my dreams a lot faster, I think. But I know that this is opportunity for those, you know, like my younger self, these kids out here to see me, to see the rise, right? And to know that they can have, you know, similar or even they could have more, you know? And I think it's often hard when you think about oppressed communities, the pressure that exists. I think the ceilings that exist for us, it's hard for us to see ourselves successful. And so much can be said for those of us who make it or are trying to make it, you know, because we provide like a lift, this kind of emotional, mental lift, I think, for us as a community to see ourselves in these spaces.
And in terms of your positivity, do you have a daily kind of commitment to this idea of like success and where you want to be in your life? And have you always had that?
I think I struggle like everybody else,
yeah.
Right? Some of us do it publicly, some of us do it privately.
In terms of this idea of, you know, this idea that you said about kind of wanting to beat people and wanting to be the best at what you do.
Mm-hmm. With sport is different, right? Yeah. You have to have that kind of killer instinctive mentality or else you'll never be successful. So I have to believe that I'm the best, that I will be the best. I have to train like I'm not the best, right? In order to be successful. Yeah. And I think in life, my energy, how I feel, it's ebbs and flows. Some days I'm like, I got this. And other days I'm like, oh, man, I don't know. And I think that's almost like the double-edged sword of, no pun intended, being successful or wanting to be successful. It's that you're always chasing what's next in life. I kind of always feel like I'm not doing enough in life. And that's just who I am as a person. Mm. You know, I feel like, man, I had a podcast yesterday. I should have answered it this way. I could have done better. I'm thinking about the panel we had earlier. Like, man, I should have answered this question a bit differently. But I feel like my mind is always moving a million miles a minute because your time here is so limited. It's like, I need to do more. I want to reach more people. I want to love myself more. I want to love the people in my life more. I feel like there's always something left for us to do.
So that like internal dialogue of like having it or not having it. So would you say that maybe the pressure comes more from within and less from like kind of other people's perceptions of you?
Oh man, I learned to abandon other people's perception of me such a long time ago. And like,
that's
it's
what
one
I
of,
find that it's, I don't really give a shit about.
Oh yeah.
I am my biggest
critic.
Yeah. I don't, yeah. Someone could have said that was amazing, but if I didn't think it was amazing, then it doesn't really matter to me. Yeah.
Right. I was so bullied as a kid.
Mm.
And I was constantly just made fun of or made to feel like I didn't belong. Like I spent my childhood in sport, but also like in the classroom where there was a lot of pressure from my parents to always, you know, get straight A's. And so in my township, for whatever reason, the advanced placement honors classes were just like dominantly white kids. And like the lower level classes, you had like the minority kids. So imagine like, you know, being in the classroom and, you know, people trying to make you feel like you don't belong because you're the only black kid in the class and make you feel like you don't belong. So I'm like, man, I need to be exceptional in order to be accepted. And I kind of felt that in sport as well. I learned that people will try to make you feel like a square in circle spaces all the time. So it's like, there's no way I'm going to please all these people. So I kind of abandoned that idea of pleasing them and said, you know what? I'm going to love myself. Whatever. You don't like me. I don't care. And that I don't care attitude has, I think, not only have I carried that with me through life, but I think it helped me be a successful athlete, right? Because when you're in a competitive sport like fencing and you're trying to lean on people and lean on this idea of inclusivity and camaraderie and unity that just like was not existing, it's easy to fail. And I just learned to be like so self-reliant, you know, and learning to lean on maybe like my sister who traveled with me or trying to use like the wisdom of my mom or like my parents or lean on my best friend who fenced for Mexico. Those were the things that helped me, not this idea that I had to please other people because they're never going to be happy with you. So it's like, why am I trying to please people who who have such a limited expectation just from me existing as a Black woman who's Muslim. They don't expect anything of me. They don't want, you know, to expect anything of me. So, like, there's not even a reason to try.
Did it make you push harder?
I think that is what has kept me going as an athlete, right? Because I feel like this space is not inclusive. This space is almost antithetical to what sport is meant to be, right? So I feel like that push and that drive comes from me wanting it for other people who look like me. You know, I want them to know that they can have this and that we, like, as a collective, need to challenge the sport of fencing and make it inclusive, make it accessible, make it a space where people feel like they belong.
Because you know what not belonging feels like.
Mm-hmm. Or being made to feel like you don't belong.
Yeah. How did that make you feel?
I mean, it's hard.
Yeah.
Like, as an adult and as a member of Team USA, I felt like the harassment, the level of pushback I received, like the othering that I felt was so strong that it was changing how I felt about myself. You know, I know that on the panel we talked about this, and I, like, in very vivid detail discuss it in my memoir, Proud. But those moments of othering, like when you're spending however many weeks on the road a year competing at World Cups, Grand Prix, training camps, we go to like 12 countries a year in our sport, and you spend so much time on the road alone, when you're not included on team dinners or even told about team practices, that stuff starts to weigh on you, you know? And I don't know, it really started to affect how I felt about myself, right? And it was affecting my happiness. I felt like it was changing this fabric of what made me, you know, who I was, and I hated that.
I suppose it brought you back to that kind of, you know, you at school as well, which is always...
Oh, I swear. Yeah.
And you think you've got through that.
It felt like Mean Girls, right? Yeah, it's like, man, I thought that was something you experienced as a kid. I didn't know you could experience that as an adult. And then you just kind of, you have this brief moment where you feel kind of hopeless, right? Because I think that as adults, we feel like we can problem solve anything. And that just felt like, man, I'm doing all the jumps and tricks that they ask of me, and they still don't love me. What else can I do? And when I learned to abandon this idea of acceptance from these people, from these teammates, from this coaching staff, that's when, like, I really kind of rose to the occasion. And I mean, I went from having no world ranking, like making my first national team, to, you know, climbing to like world number 7, because I learned that I needed to love myself. I needed to be my own biggest cheerleader in order to be successful.
That's so nice. It's really, really lovely to hear that. And we spoke downstairs about kind of being more than an athlete, and you do a multitude of things. One of them being you have a clothing company called Luella with your siblings. I think it's amazing. And I love the idea that you're doing it with your families. Can you tell me a little bit more about the clothes and why you wanted to launch the company?
So we started Luella about 5 years ago. And as someone who, at that point in my career, I was already a sports ambassador, you know, for the State Department. I was already like a member of U.S. national teams and stuff. So had a ton of speaking engagements where, as a Muslim woman, I want to dress modestly. And imagine, like, you know, constantly having to find long sleeve, floor length dresses. And this is, you know, again, years ago, really hard to find. And if you did find them, they existed from international brands. So I was always ordering from overseas. And it's expensive. Like, once you're photographed in it, you don't want to wear it again. So my brother, who lives, you know, out in Los Angeles, he said, why don't we just, you know, do our own thing, make our own clothes? And initially, I thought he was kind of crazy because we don't have a background in fashion or business, but it was about us filling a void for a community that's forgotten. You know, like, nobody's out here making clothes for Muslim women or women who specifically want to dress modestly. And if they were doing it, they weren't doing it fashionably. So that's kind of where Luella was born. It went from, you know, 10 pieces on the site to like close to 100 pieces on our site. And the goal and mission of our company is not only to produce modest clothes, but also we want them to be fashionable. We want them to be affordable. It's like all of our clothes are under $250, and we make them between or either in Los Angeles or in New York. We're a very conscious company. We work with female manufacturers who employ women. So we feel like we're creating jobs within our communities, and we're having this very real impact on our local communities. And we want our customers to be conscious about their purchase. and the things that they wear, and we want people to feel the clothes that they put on are an extension of their own beauty, and that's kind of the premise of Luella.
Do you feel like that when you're wearing them? That is
an
extension of your personality.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an extension of my personality because I always want to feel like I'm helping, right?
Yeah.
I feel like that's being a middle child and having younger sisters has very like maternal vibe to me sometimes, but I always want to feel like I'm helping and I'm being an agent of change and I'm very conscious about the things that I do. And maybe that comes from having woke parents, I don't know, but
yeah.
That's just kind of a part of who I am.
Was there a moment in your career where you knew it was going to be more than just kind of fencing and that you had ambitions of being this, like you said, an agent of change? Or was there like a kind of moment where you knew you were doing more than just fencing?
From a public perspective, yes, because I qualified for my first Olympic team at the height of the presidential election in 2016. Mm. And it was right after this proposed Muslim ban, right? And so if you qualify as the first Muslim woman to represent the United States in the Olympic Games as a very visible Muslim, to me, it was an opportunity to show not just Americans, but the world a different narrative of the Muslim community, one that challenges and flips the narrative on its head that has been pushed to us, I think force-fed to us for so long. Like when you think about the way that Muslim women are portrayed, whether it be in Hollywood or on the news media, it's a woman who has on all black, who, you know, is often Arab, and she's seen as being like, quote unquote, oppressed and having some man dictate to her whether or not she can speak or what she should wear. And it's like, actually, that's not how it is at all. Like I'm, you know, American by birth. I'm African American. I have no connection to any other country other than this one. And I am very vocal and verbal about my existence as an African-American Muslim woman because we are a huge portion of the Muslim community here in the States. We're like well over 30%. And our narrative is so forgotten, even within our community, like let alone side, like outside of it. So it's like, let me show a side of the Muslim community, a narrative to our community that hasn't been shown before. Let me show people that we can be athletes, we can be activists, you know, like I can be African-American. I can be all these things that you say I can't be.
In regards to all the things that you're showing people that you can do, what other ambitions do you have for your platform and for your future?
Such a deep question. I feel like you've been talking to my mom. She's like, what are you doing with your life? What's next? I don't know. I mean, I would love to go into broadcasting.
Yeah.
I have, just signed another book deal. I have two children's books coming out in the near future, so that'll be cool to work on. I'm always thinking about the what's next. I know I said that earlier, but I feel like, you know, it's a limitless imagination, right? I feel like my wheels and my mind are always turning because the opportunity exists, you know, if you believe that it does, and you kind of create your own lane and your own journey. And I just have always been this kind of person, doesn't take no for an answer. So what comes next? I don't know. But I feel like, God willing, it's all good.
And it's so beautiful what you said about believing it exists, because I think for so long we've been told, no, 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 no.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so beautiful that what happens when it flips into believing that you know that you can occupy these spaces and you can do all these amazing things that you've seen so many other people do.
Mm-hmm.
And you're a product of like that belief and all the work that goes into it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing to see. It's a real blessing to be sat here with you and just kind of like feeling your like amazing energy. You know, obviously no one else can see it right in this space here, but on, you know, it's, there's so much honesty in everything that you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice to see that.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I feel like I could pinch myself sitting across from you because I feel like I've seen you so much. And what I love about the way that you use your platform and the things that you do is you know that we all know that there's more to you than, you know, just being a model. You know, I love the idea of using your platform for good and reaching people in ways that most people could care less about because they're so self-absorbed, you know. And I love your work, whether it be from mental health to reaching even the girls here today. I feel like it means a lot. And I know that we were blessed to have and sit with you today, even me more so, because I get to be on your podcast, which I'm excited about. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Girls Share.
Next, we have Girl Share. This is where I usually, and I do read an amazing submission that comes from our community. And today, I want to share a beautiful submission from Megan. Resilience is the superpower that forces you to get back up, to never let life keep you down for long and keeps the fight going on when you yourself see no way of returning. Resilience is an armor that for me, I have always associated with women. It is a faith that no woman can escape and one that we are thrust into knowing from an early age. We are fighting battles at every point in life, and the only way we see women survive life is through resilience and an undeniable force of determination and bravery. We must survive, we must soar, and we must thrive. We do this not only for ourselves, but for other women, so they know they can succeed and they can endure what life so unfairly deals them. Women have shown me hardship, breakup, pain, and devastation, and yet they fly higher than the birds in the sky. They know love, compassion, intelligence, and understanding. They reach new levels and break boundaries. They take care of themselves and each other. They have given me sisterhood and a safe haven because these beautiful women know resilience. They know nothing in this world can stop them, and that, in fact, nothing will ever, ever break us because we won't let it. And that is what resilience is to me. I urge women to never doubt themselves or give up on themselves. Life needs resilient women. Women need resilient women. And if it ever feels like resilience has left your side, know that actually it lives in your blood and your bones, and it will never truly leave you. I owe my life to women, and I care deeply about them forever. I wish life didn't force us to be as resilient as we have learned to be. I hope you know freedom just as well as you know resilience.
Love that.
Lovely. Mm-hmm. It is. I think we just have to kind of, I just had to look at all of you sitting on the panel, and we all have come from different backgrounds, and we've all, our journeys have all been different in terms of how we've, you know, come to kind of be all sat here together. But we definitely have many a thing in common, and resilience definitely being one of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much for that, Megan.
Girls Listen.
Next, we have Girls Listen. I always ask my guests to share a tip of strength. As someone who's had to overcome many obstacles, what mantra or tool has helped you to get where you are today?
My life mantra that I live by is to have faith over fear. There's been so many times in my life where I feel like the anxiety or fear becomes paralyzing. And it's one of those things where we know in sport that so much of it is mental, right? The people who show up for themselves mentally in sport and who are so consistent about it, those are the athletes that we'll be talking about for generations. And I've learned that if I have faith, you know, in myself, if I have faith in my abilities and all the hard work that I've put in, all those hours and blood, sweat, and tears, I can't allow my fear to override that, you know? And I think faith is what helps us get up every morning and put one foot in front of the other, and something you can't live without, you know? It'll suffocate you. Fear can be suffocating and debilitating. So my mantra is faith over fear.
Girls Take Action.
So last but not least is Girls Take Action. Given you have committed to the LA 13.1 race, do you have any advice for our listeners when it comes to committing to a sporting goal?
Committing to a sporting goal. Why not just get out there and try it?
Yeah.
Right? I am so fearful of the idea of having to run 13.1 miles, but there's also the idea that, you know, I can't do it. And it's like, actually, I kind of like that there's this gray area because I'm not a runner of, like, I don't know, it's going to be very difficult, but I love the idea of conquering your fears. And for anyone out there who has a sporting goal, it's like, get out there and have fun. I get this question from people all the time, like, how do I make my kid an Olympian? I'm like, no, that is not the goal. The goal is that you have fun.
Yeah.
And no matter what your level of fitness is, I think just getting out there and having fun should be the ultimate goal.
Thank you so much, Adash, for being on my podcast in LA. And thank you for being on my panel.
Thank you for having me.
Mad love. And as always, mad amounts of love. We may have stopped talking, but that doesn't mean you have to. Talk to us on our Instagram at Girls Talk, or send us your poetry, essays, stories, artwork, or anything else you want to share at girlstalk.com. Mad love to Nike for helping us to create such great chat and even better actions for our girls. We are always here and we're always listening. I'm Adjoa Boa. This was the Girls Talk podcast, and you are amazing.